Welcome to Talking History. Our special guest is Mark Ross. Mark Ross is a resident of Butte, Montana, and he's a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and he might loosely be called a folk singer, but we'll let Mark talk a little bit more about who he is and what he does, and welcome him to the show. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Greg. Yes, I'm here as Montana's most famous unknown folk singer. We're going to, talk about, booming the West, and how it used to be and how where it's going now.
Part of what we want to talk about as we think about the idea of workers on the move, boomers, as you like to call them, is the idea of the hobo and his part, his or her part in the culture, because there were many women hobos, too, at one time. But the word hobo itself, let's talk about where that word actually came from. I think there's probably a couple of derivations, but what's your take on it?
Well, the two that I'm aware of, actually I'm aware of three, but we'll get to that third one later. The two that I'm aware of is that it was the greeting, ho boy, how you doing, hello, and then ho boy from using a hoe on the farm, going from farm to farm, doing stoop labor. And there seems to be some connection with there's the high wood, bois in French, somewhere there. And then there's somebody who claims it comes from the Japanese. I've just recently read about that, and I had a linguist friend of mine look it up, and it seems like there's a Japanese word hobo that seems to I think it means beg, but I they may have taken it from us.
Interesting how once a word becomes entrenched in a culture or established in a culture, it automatically almost becomes the status quo for it to have multiple derivations, multiple definitions.
Oh, yeah, it's like the origin of the word wobbly. Where did it come from?
Right.
Meaning a member of the IWW. Yeah, we don't know, and unless we get a time machine, we can pinpoint the exact moment in the space-time continuum when this word was arrived at. We're never going to know for sure. We can only speculate.
Well, and those two words are sort of synonymous, and we're going to talk about that in a couple of minutes, but I wanted to also talk about the cultural misconceptions about the word hobo, and then there are other sort of gradations there with hobo, bum, tramp.
Well, the general consensus of the public is that they're all interchangeable, and what was Ben Reitman? Who once said that, a hobo works and wanders, a tramp dreams and wanders, and a bum drinks and wanders. You could go from one to the other in the same trip, but they're not all the same.
And Ben has his own special place in the American history of hobos.
He was king of the hobos for a while. He was also Emma Goldman's lover and tour manager. He was the guy the vigilantes kidnapped in San Diego in 1913, hauled him out on a dirt road and tarred and feathered him and burnt the initials IWW into his buttocks with a lit cigar.
So Ben sort of paid his dues.
Oh, more than once.
There was an age of the great tramps that's been referred to in our culture. And it's one of those pieces of the American history lesson that is sort of left out of the mainstream history books.
It was the 1890s, and there was great social turmoil in those years. What with the Panic of 1893? We called them panics back then. They didn't become a depression until 1929. I was a depression baby. My mother said I was the most depressing thing she'd ever seen. So the 1890s, and who came out of that? Jack London, Carl Sandburg spent a year or so as a wandering worker, right, working the wheat harvest, riding the freights back in the 1890s. There were a lot of people who did back then. You know, there were some who started back then, and most of them were victims of the 1894 Pullman strike, Eugene Victor Debs' American Railway Union. They were blacklisted railroaders. They used to go around, you know, go around booming from road to road. You know, in those days, you show up at a road to get hired on as a brakeman or a switchman, and the yard master or the roadmaster would say, who here's had experience? And the guys who raised their hands who were missing fingers, those are the ones who got hired.
Right. And so there lies really the heart of the misconception in a lot of ways about those who work and wander, is the fact that they're not there because they had necessarily some inborn tendency to wanderlust. It was because of economic reasons.
Yeah, they were forced to. You know, they didn't have any choice in the matter. Besides, a moving target's harder to hit.
And it also was part of the great success of some of the workers who did choose to work and wander, because they were booming into town, and they had strategies that developed from this behavior.
Well, yeah, you could make enough, you know, work on the summer wheat harvest, starting in Texas, working your way up to the Canadian border or even further north, where you could make enough that you wouldn't have to work all winter. You could, you know, get yourself a winter steak and jungle up in some flop house in town, you know, usually in Chicago around Madison Street. You know, well, who is it? Thoreau. He figured out how he could work 6 weeks to live the rest of the year without working, you know, and the tramps, you know, carried it as far as they possibly could.
Right. I mean, why not?
Oh, yeah. The only reason we work is so we don't have to anymore.
Now, you mentioned people like Jack London, and he actually, while he became more famous in the mainstream for his adventure stories, he also wrote some working class type stuff from his experiences, but it didn't come about necessarily from his whole sense of identity with the movement as much as it did as a later product of his success, it seems.
Yeah, well, he was, you know, he wasn't necessarily consistent. Of course, what was it Emerson said? A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. But yeah. Jack had, you know, started out very poor, you know, and what was it before he managed to get away to go to college, which was or even just prep school, I think, in his case, and which was a big step for a child of the working class back then. He was working in the laundry for like 15 cents a day for 12 hours a day or so, 12, 16 hours a day. But he'd been an oyster pirate, and then fell in with a bunch of road kids and learned how to ride the freights. And he was in with Coxey's Army. He was with the Western Branch, Kelly's Army, that came out of San Francisco and Oakland, Sacramento. Of course, Jack, being the individualist that he was riding, you know, 15 miles ahead of the rest of the caravan, picking up all the good stuff for himself and his confreres before sending it back to the Army. You know, but he rode all the way cross country on that trip. Of course, that was the trip that ended him up in the penitentiary in Erie, Pennsylvania. You know, that's enough to color your thoughts on the subject.
Yeah, I mean, he did write pretty eloquently about his experiences.
Oh, that book, The Road, is absolutely wonderful. You know, of course, he managed to, he wrote that many years later. You know, it was a good 10, 11 years after that. But his description of holding down the Overland Express despite the efforts of all the train crews is just a joy to read. You know, it's romantic as hell, but it's, you know, the reality is always somewhat different.
Now, we saw a resurgence again for economic reasons of those who were working and wandering, and certainly some who were doing some of the other wandering during what we called, as you said, it became from a panic to a depression after 1929 and through the 30s.
Well, yeah, but, well, I mean, up until the the spread of influence of the internal combustion engine and the automobile, most of the wandering workers in this country had no choice but to travel by trains. On the western roads, an IWW card was your ticket. You know, who was it? Mike Kotziban. You didn't know Mike, did you? He was an old Hungarian wob I knew, and he joined up in 1914. He was thrown off a freight on the working the wheat harvest because he didn't have a red card. He had an IWW card. He said, "Hot damn, I didn't know you had to join. Where do I sign up?" And he had been a member ever since when I met him in the 70s. You know, that was the way to get around. It was only after Henry Ford made cars cheap enough that a working stiff could afford one that, you know, the hobos turned into flivver tramps, as they called them, or, you know, rubber tramps, now they're called.
But as I understand, the phenomenon with the red card was such that it wasn't just the workers, the riders, but it was actually the railroad people who honored the card too.
Well, it started, I mean, at one point, some of the brakemen and conductors would hold you up for money to let you ride their train. But after the union became so well organized, and some of those railroad workers became a little more class conscious, they would forego the money if you could show your a paid up IWW card. And there was always at least one delegate on any train you could find back in those days. So if you had the money, you could buy your card if you needed it right then and there.
Little instant union shakedown there.
Yep.
Now, you had mentioned some phrase work, a little phraseology before, jungling up and things like that. And there is a whole ritual and language culture that the hobos have developed over time. I thought we'd like to talk a little bit about how some of those words are used and maybe how some of them came about. But why don't we talk about some of the ways that the hobos communicated, first of all. They had and still probably in some cases, use a series of road hieroglyphics.
Not so much anymore, although you can still see the monikers inscribed on the boxcar walls, Herbie. You ever see a Herbie, a guy in a sombrero sleeping under a palm tree? That turned out to be a railroad worker down in I think St. Louis. Did a couple of thousand of those, and there was J.B. King Esquire, which you're supposed to write it in a fine Palmerian hand without lifting the chalk off the wall, and I've seen it done. Somebody showed me how to do it. I can't do it. My handwriting is chicken scratches, but the old hieroglyphics, it was like a picture of a cat. That was the sign for a kind-hearted woman lives here, and if you had a square with four legs under it, that meant there was a dog, and sort of looked like a tic-tac-toe square. That meant there was a mean, the cops would throw you in jail if they caught you, The tramp parlance, argot, the slang, has existed for hundreds of years. Martin Luther, the leader of the Protestant Reformation, did a dictionary, a lexicon of German tramp slang in the 16th century. I'm still trying to track down an English translation of that myself. Anybody out there knows one? I think it was translated and published in London in 1860. Get in touch with Greg. Let me know a Xerox copy will do. The bindle, which was your belongings wrapped up in a bedroll. Well, the older tramps called that a balloon. Of course, we never really walked along with a stick with everything wrapped up in a bandana over our shoulders. That was a little more Norman Rockwell-ish, I guess you could say. But the words are still out there, to jungle up or to get a lump, which means to get a handout. And a chicken was a gump. And an old experienced hobo was a jocker. And a new kid was a prescient, and what else? I mean, then there were the yeggs, the criminals who used the freights as a means of transportation, safecrackers and bank robbers. They're, you know, you could, I think, who's it, Eric Partridge did a whole piece on tramp slang. Anyway, you know, all that slang is out there and to some extent is still used, although the old tramp culture, the old hobo culture seems to be disappearing, you know, along with the old hobos. The trains move much too fast. In the old days of steam, the train had to stop, what, every 100 miles to take on water, so you always found a hobo jungle at the water tank. You know, people have become much more scared of strangers. To get a job now, you have to prove your identity. Yeah, the trains are much too fast. They stop too infrequently. You know,
they've changed.
It's not the same. It's not the same.
Yeah,
you know?
The designs have changed too. Where it's not as easy to hitch a ride on a
no. Now they've got all those container cars. You know, the double stack containers. If you want, I'll give you a little tip. If you're going to ride, and you have to be careful. You look for the container car that has the upright ribs on the outside. Those have a platform on the end. The ones without those ribs are open. You can't, riding there would be extremely dangerous. But the ones with the ribs, there's a place to ride in back out of the wind.
So
that's a tip for those of you planning to catch out tomorrow and head south before it gets too damn wet and cold around here.
The modern hobo has become more of a maybe more in the bum mode rather than the hobo or the tramp mode.
I still know some who ride the freights to get to work. You know, there was. You know, Railroad Dick Garvey lived up in Whitefish, Montana. He used to ride the freights down to Florida, work on the loading dock of the Havatampa factory down in Tampa, Florida, every winter. That's how he'd spend his winters. You know, there was a fellow named Ken Lowney lives up in Butte. I see Ken all the time. Well, Ken was cutting through this junkyard, and there were some motors for a turbine, you know, wrapped in copper. It was in Helena, Montana. It was right next to the tracks, and they weighed about 80 pounds each. It took him about 4 trips because he knew of a junkyard in Spokane that was right next to the tracks. And, you know, he could make $80 a trip riding over to Spokane overnight, you know, getting on the night train heading west out of Helena, ride into Spokane, shove that 80 pounds of metal off the track, and drag it over to the junkyard, sell it for $40, $50, you'd ride back to Helena and get the next one. So the old tramps are still out there. You know, you have to, some of us, there are guys who used to ride in the 30s and 40s, you know, some in the 50s. If you can get them to talking about it, you can get some interesting stories. You talk to the guys who used to ride on steam before diesel. They're the interesting ones. One guy, Don Ritter, he died a couple of years ago. He'd been thrown out of the Korean conflict. He was in the army. He'd slugged his officer, slugged a captain, so they gave him a dishonorable discharge. And he was on the bum for, 45 years. You know, was getting SSI somehow. I'm not sure. He had a good gaff going, as we say. He said the Jehovah's Witnesses came up to him and asked him if he wanted to be one. He said, "I'm sorry, I didn't even see the accident." Hand to God. He really said that. He'd say that, yeah. I'm not rambling too much.
No, you're fine.
I tend to get sidetracked.
Yeah, sidetracked.
As long as I don't get derailed on the train of thought.
Well, I mean, if you have any other, if you want to throw any other anecdotes in there about some of the guys you know, too, I don't know.
Any more
off the top of your head is fine. But I was going to ask, how did you get involved? What was your personal introduction to riding the rails?
Riding the rails, Labor Day weekend, 1980, playing in Whitefish, Montana, at the Great Northern Bar. And 2 years before, I had left my banjo and fiddle with some friends of mine in Kansas City, and I figured this was the perfect opportunity to go get it, go get them. And so finished working, you know, Sunday night at the bar, and fiddle player, a lady named Stephanie Davis, who now writes songs for Garth Brooks. She was playing with us at that time, and she drove me up to the yards, and I saw somebody walking across and said, anything going east? And he said, yeah, you know, number such and such is on track 11. So she drove me over across the yards on the overpass, and there was a, sure enough, long train parked there, a lot of grain cars. I could see the car knockers going up and down with their lanterns, checking the wheels. And I walked up to him, said, is there any empties on this train? You know, this is eastbound, isn't it? They said, yeah. I said, any empties? They said, sure, there's a empty caboose about halfway up. Hot damn. So I ran back and got my bindle and my guitar, and I said goodbye to Stephanie and ran up there and got on this caboose. And I was feeling a little guilty. Here's going to be my first, you know, real freight ride on my own, and I'm going to ride in comfort. Well, I needn't have felt guilty, because about 30 seconds before the train pulled out, crew car pulled up next to the caboose, and the crew got on the caboose and informed me that this was now the crew car. All those grain cars had been derailed up at Libby and had been deadheaded into Whitefish, where they were being dropped off, and this was now the ass end of the train, and I'd have to find another place to ride. And just as the train started to pull out, there was a boxcar right in front, and I hopped in that, and I sat there for 32 hours. So we got to Minneapolis.
How were the conditions overall, temperature-wise?
Well, froze the first night going through Glacier, and then started to boil once we got out onto the plains. Made a major gaffe in Staples, Minnesota. I was standing in the boxcar door being picturesque, you know, and bandana around my neck, my old hat tipped back on my head with the brim turned up, smoking a cigarette. And I slowed down as we came through Staples, and there was a Gandhi dancing crew, you know, track crew, drinking their morning coffee in front of the depot. And I just stood there, and they just saw me and cracked up and started laughing. And, you know, we went into the hole, pulled over on a sidetrack a couple of minutes later outside of town to let another freight pass us coming the other way. And brakeman in the caboose behind me, from behind, came up and said, you know, we know you're here, but do us a favor, stay inside when we go through town. don't get us in trouble. I said, oh, sorry. Boy, was I embarrassed, red-faced.